It was also turned up in Time Magazine, October 27th of 1952. Here we have J.D. telling his... Still wearing the same tie, I guess. Right. And in all the newspaper stories to boot. So I'll turn it over at this point to J.P. and you can tell us what he found out about the Scully book.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to ask your indulgence, if I may. I was running to answer the telephone the other evening and ran right into a door and broke a toe. So if I let it sit down, Bob was trying to give me a little bit better, a little different introduction. I won't say better. That was a nice introduction, I think, which I remember. But do you suppose you could favor the folks with the excerpt from the
Roswell? Oh, that's right. I'm sorry, I forgot. I was going to recite his pedigree. As comes from Charles Corbett and William Moore in the Roswell incident, wrote that they went and they interviewed Mrs. Frank Scully. Frank Scully is deceased now. His widow described J.P. Kahn as, quote, a most unscrupulous journalist from San Francisco, end quote, who may have been paid off to do, quote, the hatchet job on Scully. It is true that Kahn's article on Scully and his book is full of exaggerations and inaccuracies. Unfortunately, other journalists followed Kahn's account without bothering to check his accuracy. In any event, it was indeed Kahn's article that proved most damaging. Well, I'll let you folks make your own decision tonight as to the accuracy of his account as substantiated by his newspaper stories and so on, and weigh that credibility of that on one side versus the credibility of the people from MUFON and the other groups who are saying that the Roswell incident was a genuine flying saucer crash. Mr. Unscrupulous?
Thank you very kindly. I guess it was Bob who pointed that out to me, and I, for a moment, I thought, you know, unscrupulous journalist, I worked pretty hard all my life. I had a number of things, including writing, and I thought maybe I'd get my attorney to straighten those gentlemen out. And then I realized that they had done me a great service. Because all I ever was just a hack rewrite man, feature article guy. I write your laundry list, you pay me for it. But a journalist, that's quality stuff. So we decided to just let the whole thing simmer down. The other evening I was listening to the Washington TV and listening to it, and I just caught the tag end of Chief Justice Warren Berger's comment, and I wrote it down. He said, he took the position that the attorneys and journalists find themselves at the bottom of the ladder of social acceptance, as possibly because of the company they find themselves in, meaning, I guess, one or and the other. So I am here today. I am neither in favor of flying saucers nor against flying saucers. I happen to get onto this story, and we'll get into that right now. But I'm not an expert. I suddenly became a flying saucer expert, and believe you me, it has cost me a lot of time and trouble, but I've had a lot of fun doing it. I was not working at the Chronicle. I was helping my father, who had a store up in Stockton, California. And I got a hold of this same book, Tom has, Mind the Flying Saucer. You can see I worked it over a little bit, massaged it around. I made some other careful notes in the back of it. And I called up my old boss, Scott Newhall, who was then executive, who was editor of This World, of all stuff, still writing the paper. And I said, Scott, I just finished reading a book called Behind the Flying Saucers, and I will guarantee you, and I have worked for them for some years prior to this, I'll guarantee you we've got one of two things. We have the greatest story since the resurrection, or the greatest folks since the Court of the Giant. And I'm anyone here is unfamiliar with the Cardiff Giant? The guy had a big stone body buried, carved out, buried, hid it, and exhumed it. And if there's a real stone man, I think it would have to be one or the other. It was a great, tremendous story or a tremendous hoax. Just come on down and go to work. By that time, I had the chores cleaned up the store pretty well. So I went down. The first thing they have to do, just like they do on the TV, you have to have a cover story. Now, this is what's called, today, this is called investigative reporting. This was in 1950, this book was published, and this was about, I guess, 1950, that this happened, began. So Scott Landis thought it would be very fun to give me a cover story on the petroleum industry. How is it doing today? And this gives you access, this gives you a lot of latitude. You can ask for stats here. You can go in the library here and there. And you can poke around. And what are you doing? Well, I'm doing a little statistical reporting for the Chronicle and their syndicate on petroleum. All right, fine. Well, that's the cover story result set. But then what do you do when you read a book of this nature? You find some obvious clinkers. And I mean clinkers. How many of you here do not know what the periodic table is? Do not know. You all know it. Okay. Periodic table, very briefly, is a table of elements that we know for sure and have computed that they're around. And we can, check me if I'm wrong, because I'm no scientist, but we can take the light from the stars and we can tell you exactly what that star is made up of, the planet is made up of by a spectroscopy. So when I saw in here that they had discovered a planet, a metal, unknown to the planet, I thought, now wait a minute, something is not so good here. And then there were a few others, but where did you begin? So what I'm going to try to do this evening is that Bob gave you a very good quick outline of the story itself. I'm going to give you, as best I can, a quick outline of what do you do when you've got a hot one like that? How do you go about it? Well, the first thing that I did was to read that book until I, at that time, I could practically quote you page, chapter, verse, and number. And then I made lists. I started in the back of the book. There was not a pen paper. So I had long lists of contradictory material, long lists of questions that were left hanging, you know, like the other shoe waiting to drop. So now I have all of this material available. And the Chronicle's paying me to do this. And I'm poking around, trying to find if this Mr. Silas M. Newton in legitimate circles existed. And indeed he did. But now that I know this much about this book, I will go and have a chat with the author, Mr. Scully. And Frank turned out to be an absolutely super guy. He had lost one leg, I don't know how. He was then, I would say, about his middle 60s, you know, an old man like I am. And he had seven children, I believe, or five, something like that. Very nice wife, lived in Hollywood. He was writing a daily column for Variety, as Bob said, the trade magazine. And he was outraged, absolutely outraged, that I would question this. I said, well, gee, Mr. Scully, this doesn't add up. There is no such thing as a metal unknown to this earth, or any other substance for that matter. We know what's in this petty larceny universe of ours. That's about all we do know about it. We know the junk it's made of. And there's some pretty credible sources that can demonstrate that. I think someone has sold you a bill of goods here. They said, well, why would they want to do that? I could not figure out. I didn't know what the motive was. Just like in the TV, you have to have a motive. Well, we hemmed and hawed, and I said, Frank, wouldn't it be possible? Now, mind you, I'm trying to persuade a gentleman who's very heavily biased. in the midst of a relatively small home with five or seven children, two big dogs going forth and back, and a wife trying to corral some of them, and the kids, other friends coming in, hey, can I borrow your bike, Tommy? And so forth. It was not really conducive to a quiet, thoughtful interview. And Mr. Scully was an Irishman, and he was a good combative Irishman, and he was not about to take any other position than what he had. He had, incidentally, one of his greatest contributions was, and I think still is, in print. It's called a book called It's Fun in Bed, and it's not what you think at all. he wrote it when we worked quite as liberally as we were every day. It's puzzles and little short stories and stuff you can do when you're lying in the hospital. It's a neat little book. And by no means am I here to deprecate Frank Scully. So I said, tell you what, why don't you think it over? And I will pursue my own course and I'll come back to you and see if there's any possibility for changing your mind. I then made a trip up to Mount Palomar, the slope of which, you know, Mount Palomar, they have a 200-inch telescope, and they also have a character named Mr. Adams, Dr. Adamski, if you please. I don't know what his doctor is in, but he has his own telescope that's made out of a couple of lenses, or was. I doubt seriously that structure still remains. And he had a little restaurant, and his wife was, hustling hamburgers, and he could park up there and take a spin through the telescope for $0.50, and then he'd show you a piece of fast flying saucers, because they were very big in those days, that had landed, and it looked more to me like a broken end of a piano, you know, where all those wires come together, and it was a kind of a neat looking piece of stuff, but I didn't really think it had come from the outer spheres. But I could get nothing out of Adamski. Principally because he didn't have it. So I kept going along. Then I got a hold of Scully again. He was absolutely adamant in his position. And then I began to find in Denver, because that's where the Newton Oil Company was located, I began to find a few little leaks here and there. It sounds so good. The Newton Oil Company, I expected it to be an area of substance. You know, four or five offices, a half a dozen girls, and the Telex drawing and the charts, and that thing they have to get you way down the bottom while all that didn't happen. It was one very nicely furnished small room. With one very nice, quite elderly lady. May I help you? I said, yes, I'd like to speak to Mr. Newton. Well, he's not here at the moment, he's out in the field. That's appropriate. So I said, well, how could I ever reach him? And I thought, he's getting a little bit edgy. He said, does he reside here in Denver? Yes, but he's in out in his various plants. You know, he rediscovered the Rangely oil field. Rangely was one of the largest fields ever discovered until Saudi Arabia opened up. Mr. Newton did not discover it. That gave me another little piece. See, as I was going along, I was adding to my collections of non sequiturs to Mr. Scully's book. Every time anyone opened his mouth, sooner or later something would come out that I wrote it all down. Some of it was quite true. But every now and again, a clinker. So I thought, all right, I am going to have to play foxy ball with these people. That's after all, a man is paying. So I undertook, the confidence of a young and totally ignorant. I can't believe it. I undertook to out-con two of the slickest con men that have ever existed in the United States, at least to the best of our knowledge. And I'm including the Yellow Kid and a few of the high flyers, because they all went down. Newton, as we'll see in a moment, and no one had ever touched him. But innocent me, I didn't know that. He mentioned he was a member of the Burning Bush Country Club. This is a a very high-class golfing attorney from Washington, D.C. He is not an attorney for plaintiffs on a wire to do that. I told the lady in the office, I was a newspaper reporter, come all the way from San Francisco on the strength of Mr. Frank Scully's book. We interviewed this man who obviously had a geophysical world at the very fingertips. And I was terribly sorry I couldn't even find him. Let me see if I can put him in touch with you. And I was stopping at the Crown Palace Hotel, which is a three-minute hotel up there, and it still is. And within, I would say, half a day, Mr. Newton had emerged from the field. I don't know what field he was in at that moment, but I had a little chat with Mr. Newton, and he was extremely impressed. He was very well dressed. It was just exactly like a high-class but working oil executive should look. He had a big leather satchel, and you could just see the dust of the desert on it, and the nocturne, gradual, scraggly rocks. He had all sort of charts and papers and all the good stuff, the props, everything was perfect, and he had the language to go with. So we made arrangements to meet in San Francisco. So I had several important people I have to meet there. A large deal, but I can't really tell you all about this, and I'm going to do the work in government, get more flying on like this, forth. Well, when you're in the newspaper business, you do develop a few contacts here and there, and you will trade cups of sugar back over the fence. You do me a favor, and I'll do you a favor, and we ain't going to neighbor, I was going to say nothing. So every time you mention the government agency, either I could check it, or one of my buddies on the papers could check it, never heard it. So, we had a meeting in the Palace Hotel. And D&D had a suite there. And he had this nice satchel with him. And I brought my boss along, Mr. Scott Newhall. We're really laying a big con on the con man. My name is Con, but it's not spelled that way. It's been plagued me all my life. But here the orchestra is playing behind the potted palm, you know, and everything is going down very nicely in the guard courtroom. And all of a sudden, this timid father, and you ever see it like this? Here, a couple of little gears, and you stuck them on the fork, and they had a beautiful sound. In fact, well, I never had seen anything like that. It certainly wasn't beyond my belief, because the two diameter machines could crank one out pretty fast. Then he said, look at this. And here he had something. And I looked all over Bob. I cannot find what he pulled out of his pocket. I have it somewhere. Well, I only have half. I give half. The other half to you all. And I give a little piece to Sam Church to test. These are pieces of metal unknown to this earth. They look like a knockout plug from a electrical box, you know what I'm talking about, side of the nickel and tall metal. I said, gee, would it be possible? We can certainly give you a marvelous write-up in the paper, and, you know, a two or three series. You can have that, have it analyzed. And he said, well, no, I can't do this. Very much secret government work. Bang, these things disappeared. One of the gentlemen Mr. Newton was going to talk to was turned out to be a house painter. And so I would like you to meet this man who was taking the trouble to write to me. You'll see things I do for people. Well, unfortunately, this man was just a house painter, although he had a card and a letterhead that looked very substantial. And Mr. Newton brushed him off so fast that your head spin. Then, I'm not really very, very smart. I don't have to tell you this. You get on it sooner or later. But I began to realize what was happening. So Mr. Newton disappeared one way. I went back to Chronicle. And we had nothing to go on, nothing to print, no lead, no nothing. But then I went to the house painter. He said, yes, I wanted to talk to Mr. Newton about flying saucers, because I read that book. And he wouldn't even talk to me. He wanted me to talk about investing in oil. He'd already talked to me a couple of days before we met, and he was asking to meet you in the Palace Hotel. It was a very nice call. So
I went back to see Scully. Mr. Scully goes, what did you mail again? Did you get any mail on this? Oh, he said, you got all kinds of mail. That's what do you do with that mail? He says, well, Mr. Booth comes in and reads it. Dr. G, the mysterious scientist who works for the government, and is a magnetic specialist, comes and looks at this. They're taking, oh yes, they take science calls. There it is. I don't see why you weren't trying this all along. I said, well, I'm just interested. You know, I've told you before, I think there's something wrong here, and I don't want you to be caught in the middle. I said, let me see some of that mail. It'll be too much trouble. Well, there was mail which covered four tables this side. That's very prestigious letterheads, too. So I said, thank you very much, Mr. Scully. Now, are you sure that you won't throw in with me? Tell me who this mysterious Dr. G is that you described in your book, who saw the flying saucers, was called by the government, expert on magnetics and so forth and so on, and could not do that. No way, it's all level. Goodbye. So I went back to the Chronicle, and I said, I now know what the scam is. The scam was very simple. Because in the course of my petroleum research, I had discovered a substantial number of articles written by Mr. Silas Mason Newton, appearing in trade papers, you know, like Driller and Mudder, or whatever they call them. I'm not familiar anymore with it. I used to know all of them. But they didn't make any sense. And I talked to two or three people. I knew Standard Oil, Shell Oil. And it's all, well, nuts like this come along every now and then. Some crazy idea. And the magazine prints it because we've got to have something to run between the ads. And who knows, he may have a pretty good theory there. He may not, you know. I mean, but we don't pay much attention to it. But that was his sucker list. But you see, the people who knew about oil didn't pay any attention to it. And it's not often that the average person who has a dollar and a half kicking around in his pocket picks up the Petroleum Journal, the one, and says, my, that sounds interesting. I must get in touch with that man, Silas M. Newton, in Denver, Colorado, and have a little chat with him, and that's where he would pick up his marks. That or on the call. He was an excellent golfer. One time, amateur champion of Colorado. Got a lot of people that way. But he needed a bigger sucker list. This is how he got it. He got Dr. G, whose name was really Leo Gebauer. I'm sure he was totally wrong. Who was an electronics, not even electronics, he had a little electrical shop and supply joint, sold soldering iron tips and tests of solder and tubes and stuff like that. There were no chips in those days on the packages. And, you know, he'd go in there and buy some stuff off them. But he could wire up stuff, so he pushed this button, I'd like to ring, wire up, and that bell would ring. And they convinced poor Frank Scully of this cheap fabrication. And I'm not going to ask you to take my word for it. Here is another interesting book, by the way, in passing, Gerald Hurd, who writes under a series of other titles. Don't ever try and fool this man on my left. I had forgotten the detail of this book, but I interviewed Hurd among, I don't know how many hundred people, trying to pin this bird down, coming down, or rather Newton down. And Hurd was a then in his 80s, and he wore tennis shoes and jeans, and he had a beautiful place in Bel Air, and he walked. He said, if you want to talk to me, you're going to have to walk right along with me all the while. He's like, my God, he would wore me out. It was terrifying. But he got onto the saucer. Everybody was, now this man was straddling the fence, sliding down the razor blade of life, you know, not getting sliced anywhere. But he took the position that insects or bees were, he did write a very high class science fiction novel about bees. It's a trade of swarm of bees, they went and sapped his enemies. It's an out of print book that I forget the title of that. And I had forgotten that in this document he had said, could it be that the insects that we are not aware of, I think they're not on the periodic table either, but insects we are not aware of
could be
a Martian bees.
Martian bees, all right. And I said, no, that's another somebody else you're thinking about. He said, here's a page, opens it up, thank you. So this skeptics are pretty subtle times. Went back to Chronicle. They were tired of paying me for just running all over the country and running up hotel bills and educating myself and flying around, and I was getting kind of tired of myself. I knew I had the end of something somewhere, but what the heck could I do with it? It just didn't add. At that time I was living at Tiburon before it turned into a tourist attraction. I was living on the pier. And I had, by this time, two satchels of demonstrable errors from this book. But they weren't really newsworthy in terms of a newspaper. So I thought, well, true, I've been reading. It used to be a swell magazine. No more. I don't know what to do. And I would like any of you to take a dim view of Fawcett publications. They used to publish things like Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. Well, they subsequently turned up to a very fine publishing house and treated me so well as to be beyond belief. I got a hold of their editor, Mr. Ken Purdy, on the telephone. I was just sick and tired. I had this in my hand. I didn't know what to do with it, but I had irrefutable proof, but it wasn't, light and action took the house on fire type newspaper proof that you needed. So Brady got on the phone and said, son, if you have what you say you have, get on the airplane, bring all your junk back here, we'll pay your plane and we'll pay your hotel and everything else. If you don't have it, you pay it. I said, you've got a deal. I got a little leave off my job. And I took this stuff back to him. See, they had been running pieces on saucers. And let me read to you the position they took, because this is a pretty heavy thing. You don't see people in the public prints reversing their stated position much these days, do you? Well, these people haven't had to do it. Little box here, the Flying Saucers and True. True was the first publication to discuss flying saucers logically and comprehensively. In January 1950, the memorable article, The Flying Saucers Are Real, announced our reasoned conclusion that they were interplanetary in origin. Four articles in subsequent issues detailed important new sightings. The U.S. Air Force, meanwhile, dismissed the saucers as misrepresentations, hoaxes, and hallucinations. Events strengthened True's position. Strange sky objects kept appearing. Some scientists attempted to explain away skyhook balloons, or, alternatively, light refractions from atmospheric layers of warm air, in effect, mirages. Neither explanation fitted all the facts. Recently, the Air Force reopened and intensified its saucer investigation. Hoaxes, as well as mistakes and hallucinations, there have been, and probably will be. When any major hoax is detected, True will expose it in the public interest. And to help remove doubt from the responsibility, authentic sightings that someday may solve the riddle of the flying saucers. Well, that didn't hurt them in terms of circulation. They're just saying, okay, fine, we printed this up so far, now we're going to show you a hoax. Here are, incidentally, the pieces of the unknown metal, and I'll tell you about that in a second. What this says is just about what I've told you. I found Jabauer. Here is his picture. You all can see it there in his radio store. This is the scientific proof that Newton offered in Scully's book and subsequent places. Incidentally, one of Newton's very slick scams was to get a professor at the University of Colorado, Denver, to let him speak for the class. Now, this is the class of elementary science, element frosh stuff, class 1A effort. His function there was the speakers. Nothing to do with flying saucers at all, at all, at all. The students were to be graded on how do I evaluate this speaker? Is he 50% correct? 90% correct? 2% correct? What? That's all it was. How do I hear a man who is speaking and formulate a judgment?
in the book, it says, the material he put on the board was of such tremendous import, this was shellacked over, saved for posterity. Well, I tried shellacking it over, it's off by the time. Just try it. I thought, well, maybe they had some other kind of chalk or some other kind of shellac, or maybe they had varnish. But I soon found out that was one of those little holes I was into. But that doesn't mean anything for itself. But here's one of the things he put on. This is my drawing of his drawing. I think I can draw better than he can. Especially with this thing here. Okay. This is the saucer. 18 feet across, divide that by 9. 27 feet high, divide that by 9. 18 feet from side to side, divide that by 9. You're asking this one. 99.99 feet long. I'm told these guys about the foot system. Now we're having a hard enough time, you know, with the metrics. That's another one of those little holes. But this was serious scientific data. Now, if I was going into the realm where we were really getting into heavy punches, this is the theory of nines. One of the people asking the 0 to 9. You can see that, huh? Looks like a menorah. Nothing in 9 is 9. 1 in 8 is 9, so forth. You can see that it's all nines. If you're quick adders, as I am now, but you find out, yeah, 1 through 9 together, that adds up to 45. 45 is divisible by 9. But then we're up there. What do you do with that scraggly piece of intelligence? Well, that was shot, that was preserved. Well, by taking that point of view, I needed like the next rep. Somebody who had been conned, and nobody likes to say, I left the guy put his hand in my pocket. I was a sucker. And more than that, there's a 3-year statute of limitations on conspiracy and confidence games and matters of that nature. And if they run out, you're home free, just like you would have. In the course of this, I got a friend of mine at the bureau to pull a rap sheet on Mr. Silas Mason. His first arrest was, he was first charged in 1935 with conspiracy, opiate, attempted fraud, all sorts of no disposition. Those are all false crazy. You name it, he's been charged with it. But not one since 1935 forward, not one time he ever hit the court. Either the statute elapsed, or he robbed Peter, they Paul, they Ann, they George, and he kept going like this until somebody's statute got all these girls ahead of the game. So we wound up this piece. Tell me a funny little thing about that. Poor Ken, he was a fire rider, a great man. Hot car, in fact, this Mercer is a replica of the actual Mercer he had restored, then sold, and he had the king of car restored of car miniature makers make for him. He was an absolutely super guy, not a lot of money, but he did. I'll read you what the tag is on this. As for his one other source of information, named in the book, Silas M. Newton, Scully was very cagey about producing him either. Scully had written that Newton was one of the great geophysicists of the oil industry, with a record of successful exploratory operations that was surpassed by none. A great athlete in his college years, a golf champion, the man who rediscovered the great range of the oil field in Colorado, patron of the arts. Newton had set up an independent oil company in Denver, and so forth and so on. His Los Angeles telephone number was unlisted. Scully would not divulge it, nor would he say where Newton lived. Thus ended my first interview with the author of Behind the Flying Saucers. Getting behind the saucers, you have to wait. I was going to have trouble enough, it appeared, getting behind Frank Scully. They printed it. And just a little sidebar,
I was green as a pea. I'd sold a few things nationally, but I haven't worked on newspapers, but I didn't know about this. I have these two stacks of the stuff here. I haven't written a piece yet. Mr. Brady said, well, how much do you want for that kid? And I had no idea. That's what I said. Well, Mr. Brady, I'll tell you what. You pay me what you think it's worth. And if I find out you cheated me, I'll never write another line for it. You got the deal. And believe you me, they paid me well, fairly. They sent me stuff to rewrite. They gave me back my copyright. Incidentally, just to prove that I do write some stuff other than the Flying Saucer stories, I have a little collection of stuff that I did here, and as you go out, I'll give you one free. And I don't think I have enough to go around. If you need some more, I'll get done to the Bob for you. But I'm not the Flying Saucer specialist. Okay, fine. This thing ran on, just printed in September 52. It was a matter of, I would say days till True began phoning me. We got a wire, we got a letter, we got stuff like this. I said, let me have it. So they overheaded it, which means one of the wires on the press release to me. The first one was from Mr. A.J. C. Bernard, and it contained a want ad in an L.A. paper, and in essence what it said was an urgent notice. You may as well get the full flavor of this thing here. And I now knew I was home free. Urgent notice. All persons having dealings with Silas M. Newton Oil Company, formerly of Denver, Colorado, New York, Illinois, Wyoming, California, Arizona, etc., relative to oil instruments, cosmic rays, and or flying saucers, kindly contact box M504 by letter or wire. This is most urgent. I wired. I immediately went to see Frank Scully. I said, Frank, look, this is all she wrote. I can't go on any longer with you, but it's pretty obvious something is wrong. Okay. I'll make you this deal. Said, if you can go over to Denver, if I opened up that much, get Dr. G's name and have him put on a piece of paper that he is not the Dr. G, or that he is the Dr. G referred to in my book, then I may talk to you. I said, how am I going to do that? Well, that's something you have to work out. So I worked it out. I worked it out by virtue of the leads that were now coming in. There were three really brave men. One is a guy named Herman Corson. Big, heavy, set upon 288 pounds, about my height. Owned the delicatessen, he was his own best customer, I think. He had dropped about $3,500, which is a lot of money to him, but chicken feet to him. On one of these oil scrubbing machines. Another man is Dr. Claymore Howard. He was the man who placed that ad, and he knew the statute of limitations on his losses, which were in the $30,000 bracket, had already run. He kept on running that ad, and he would nail these wretches somewhere or other. And was I glad to meet him. He was in Denver. He said, the man you should see is a man named Herman Flader. Herman Flader invented the stainless it was the original coupling that held a hose to metal. It was the only one that guarantees no coupling. That's not on that right now. But it was sanctioned for all brake lines on railroads, truck brake lines. It was so sure that this thing. I thought, well, I'm going to meet some big guy with a cigar, you know, and another screw, big office. Here he is in a dump deal, in a nice building. And he
he and two old men were running the whole thing. The two old men, one guy was putting spools of wire of different sizes on the machines, and the other guy was taking baskets of couplings off and dumping them in boxes and things to mail. Plater himself had built the whole thing. It was German machines. Rough, tough, and he had dropped in excess of $250,000 down this rat hole. And we found that we had about 30,000 in gold and 3 months before the statute of limitations ran. I said, Herman, with your education, and he was a stable, happy, he had good clothes, mind you, but when I met him, I thought he was a janitor or something. I said, how on earth could a man who knows this much about machinery get taken by some guy to come along with a boxer and press a button? He said, when I built something with my mallets, it works. And I expect somebody else to do the same thing. I said, have you got enough mallets in here to get up there and admit you were taken? He says, you bet I have. I said, let's go. So we went down to Bert Keating, who was DA of Denver then. And we know that district attorneys do not like to see this sort of music coming into court. This is worse than the leprosy. But it's really involved, convoluted, but we had the stuff, and the nice part was Plater was a leading citizen of Denver. He gave them a huge piece of property up there for their airfield. So Bert had no options. Besides which, I was now working, I signed on with the Denver Post, and we had Bert, who was a swell guy, but I understood what he was up against. So he said, okay, fine. And they filed the appropriate papers, so the statute would not run. I eliminated a very important part of the story, which I think I should tell you, and then we'll get to the thing, and then we'll get out. I'm running along. I had to have, if you're ringing a nail into a wall, I had to have one of those pieces of metal from going to the street. When I knew Hall, my editor in the Chronicle, odd enough, I created a machine shop. He used to restore cars and all sort of stuff. We spent more time in the junkyards looking for hemispheric engines than we did on the newspaper. So he had seen it, I had seen it, and we choose the bar. We'll make some from memory. Some of them thicker, some of them heavier, some of them all nail, some of them aluminum. And then I carried around my pockets. In those days I wore vests. I was not known to wear any vest dress or pocket. You can't wear it. And to age them, you know, to try little mix on them. Then I got a magician friend to teach me how to switch. And actually, I said, now, how do you do the switch? I'll get Newton, I'll get him to produce this thing, I'll cut out, and you pick it up and admire him and switch it. We got Newton one time. Third time. My magician friend, who was an engineer on one of the radio stations in San Francisco, Hal McIntyre, very nice guy. He said, I can't take this any longer, and you know, I have no budget now. So I said, well, show me how to do it. He did, and I practiced. And one day, I'm going out all the time, loaded with these things, I'm casting the bait, luckily, by, I don't do any fishing, but I'm suckering Newton on, you see, to give him publicity. This second story hadn't fit yet. The first one, and he didn't know about this yet. We made the switch before the switch came. That's right. That's how I sold that story. All of a sudden, I'm sitting in Newell's office. He pulled this thing out, and it didn't look any more like anything I had on me than you do. But I thought, well, I got to win this somehow. So the trick that Hal taught me was never enough. No, you're a good magician. I saw some stuff at your house the other day. There's probably a lot of you guys in here. But to me, this is magic job. Don't ever look at your hand. So I take this thing up. I'm looking at it. I said, why? It's not interesting. I've got the other one anyway. He's in here. And I pass the fourth one back. And I have mine now is going back in his handkerchief. And I'll tell you, if 100,000 forces that they're pulling on my head. They couldn't have made much more of the energy. I wanted so badly to look at that thing, but I didn't. I said, thank you very much, Mr. Bill. I dropped it in my pocket. And I said, well, now, we'll talk about the series. And a half hour later, was in a bus traffic, and I was at SRI. And it was 2SLU, if you guys know 2SLU, and it was popping anything. That was the metal unknown to the surgery. Well, now, we got him to trial.